inverse Compton wavelength, which gives us an energy scale. So the kinetic energy is given by 1 over lambda, or this is just the Compton wave number of the boson. And this has to go to the uncertainty relation, k, wavelength, and momentum. This has to go like 1 over r. Now that momentum we have here. So the Compton wavelength is simply given by the radius of the star. So this is a quantum fuzzball. Quantum fuzzball, so it's a fuzzy due to quantum mechanics. Can you imagine just a big plop, an astronomical big plop, just being a quantum ball? I mean, it's all, you can directly look into an object where you know, okay, the size of that object is the size of the uncertainty principle, so it's purely quantum uncertainty. Eerie. Yeah, this is scary. Okay. But it actually works. So if one does more detailed calculations, then with some field theoretical models, this is what comes out, actually. So let's look at the total energy, if we can stabilize it with this. So this is minus g times n times the mass of the boson. This is the mass here of the total ball. M is the number of bosons times the mass of the boson, about. Number of bosons over r plus a 1 over r. And here we need a squared. Yeah, it's kb is 1 over lambda. So kb is 2 pi over lambda Compton. That's what we assume.
So this is not the Boltzmann constant, but k for the boson. Right?
Yeah, so I can write also the momentum, maybe, is this. For me, the Boltzmann constant is always 1. Okay, so now we can actually do a similar analysis we did before, right? We see we have a negative term here, a positive term here. This goes like 1 over r. If the energy is negative, it goes like 1 over r to more and more negative values. If the energy is positive, it goes to more and more positive values. But so the star would expand. Right, so let's repeat this analysis. So if the energy is lower than 0, a star collapses. If the energy is positive, the star expands to infinity. But eventually, it reaches the non-relativistic limit. Right? Well, it loses the limit we have for the uncertainty principle, so we get a dilute gas of particles, and a dilute gas of bosons is just a non-relativistic gas of particles, and then we just have the kinetic energy of the bosons is then given by the momentum squared over 2 times the mass of the boson. And this is then proportional to 1 over r squared. The same discussion we had before for the fermions. Questions? So we find then there is a stable minimum when we go from the relativistic limit to the non-relativistic limit. And we also know that the limiting case is E equals 0. This is the limiting case for stability. And this determines the maximum mass configuration. So we can look at the maximum number of allowed bosons. So then this has to be G times NB max times the mass of the boson squared is equal 1. Okay, and then we can rewrite the maximum number of bosons is then just given by this is 1 over the Planck mass squared. The Planck mass squared over the mass of the boson squared. We see again that we have a combination of the Planck mass and the boson mass, but now it goes with the square. Remember that for fermions we had here the cubed. It goes like the ratio of the Planck mass over the mass scale of the particle to the third power. Here it just goes with the second power. Yeah, so there's a factor of Planck mass over boson mass missing. So then the maximum mass correspondingly for bosons is then given by the Planck mass squared over the boson mass. And correspondingly, the radius of the star is then just given by 1 over the mass of the boson. Yeah, again, there's a factor of Planck mass over boson mass missing. So it's by this factor that the boson star is smaller and has less mass. It's the same factor. So somehow, as it is the same factor, it will also have the same compactness as a fermion star, right? Because just this factor just drops out. The question was, why don't we use the uncertainty principle also for fermion stars? If you look at the scale, so before we reach that high momentum, that the momentum is equal to the mass of the particle, that's where we have the quantum limit, then we already have a much higher contribution from the Fermi pressure. So the Fermi pressure wins before the quantum pressure can win. By orders of magnitude, actually by 19 orders of magnitude. It's just the Planck mass over the mass scale of the nucleon. It's 19 orders of magnitude. So we would have to need to collapse the neutron star to really outrageously small values of the radius and the mass by 19 orders of magnitude. Then we would be also in the quantum limit as for a boson star. So we are going to talk about not one solar mass or two solar masses, but 10 to minus 19 solar masses. 10 to minus 19 solar masses. I mean, the Earth has 10 to minus 5 solar masses. So 10 to minus 19 solar masses, this is 10 to 33 gram per cubic. Gram is the mass of the sun. So we're talking about 10 to 14 gram. This is some mountain or something like this. Mountain size. So, okay. Good. So this was about the non-interacting case. So now we include interactions. Yeah, we do the same thing as before. So we argue that the energy density is equal to the mass of the boson times n plus a constant times n squared. And the pressure now we can actually simply put like C times n squared. Yeah. This works. This is still thermodynamic consistent because we can choose this mass scale here as we want without affecting actually the expression for the pressure. And we don't have anything in addition here. So there is we ignore actually the quantum pressure because it's much, much smaller than anything else we have. So we ignore this factor from the uncertainty principle. There would be a factor 1 over r coming in. We argue that the interaction are dominating now the quantum effects. So otherwise, they would not be important. So we don't also have, we don't have any Fermi pressure here. No Fermi pressure, no boson quantum pressure. By the same argument that we are going to see that the results we're getting are 19 orders of magnitude, usually larger than without the interactions. Yeah, and then we have the same argument as before, slightly different, but not much. Oh, here I put a gamma equal to, okay. Yeah, so for some intermediate density, actually in this case, this is also the low density limit. The low density limit is now equal to the intermediate density limit. The mass of the boson times the number density is about equal to the interaction part. Right. So then basically the corresponding critical energy density is the mass of the boson to the fourth power divided by y squared, where we now have the same definition as before, just replacing the fermion mass with the boson mass. So this goes like the boson mass over some interaction strength. Yeah, again, mi is some interaction strength. Yeah, if this is going to happen, then also the pressure is going to be equal to the energy density at that time, right? Then the pressure is about the energy density, and we have a small gamma equal 1. Yeah. If we look at this equation for some really low densities, we again have that this goes like n, and this goes like n squared. So on the really low density limit, so I should be more careful here. This is really the low density limit here. The pressure goes proportional to the energy density squared. So here we have gamma equal 2. Yeah. Or equivalently, we have a polytrope with gamma equal 2. So we, again, we have the feature that as a function of density, gamma equal 2 turns to gamma equal 1, and this is unstable. So this defines then our maximum mass. Now we can look at the mass radius curve, how this looks like. So we start with gamma equal 2, so we have a constant radius. And then eventually it turns to gamma equal 1, so we will get a maximum mass. So it will look like this. And if we increase interaction strength, this will be more pronounced and will happen at lower and lower densities. So we will have actually then several curves like this depending on the value of y, where the whole thing here, the maximum mass, again, shall increase proportional to y. This is just what we figured out, right? This is the maximum mass. Goes like y times the Landau mass. Because we have the scale here, the mass scale to the fourth power, divided by y squared. So this goes like y over the mass scale of the boson squared. Let me write this down again. The Planck mass cubed over the boson mass squared. Right. This is y times the Landau mass. And the corresponding radius now is also y times the Planck mass over. Oh, I did a mistake. No, I didn't. Yeah, and with that model, you can also compute numerically the value. Numerically, you find that the maximum mass is equal to 0.164 y times the Landau mass, and the radius is equal 0.763 times the Landau radius. Now, those values are surprisingly close to what we had actually for fermion stars, if you compare to fermion stars. I mean, we had two numerical factors, but a prefactor in front of the interaction strength here was 1.165 and 0.797, so pretty close to the other values. Slightly different, but not much. So also then the compactness, Cmax, which is g times the maximum mass divided by rc, basically is just given by the ratio of these two numerical values. And the y cancels out. So we get this is around 0.21. So it has the same as interacting fermion star. Independent on y. Pardon me? Ah, there's a y missing. Thanks. Yes. Yeah, independent on y. As for fermions. The reason is that fermion stars and boson stars in that model are so similar is because we basically ignore effects which distinguishes fermions from bosons. The whole thing is just determined by the interaction, so it doesn't really count whether one has bosons or fermions. So the Fermi pressure is not really relevant anymore. It's happening at low densities. It just changes at the low profile here, that bending over, but not really the maximum mass. And that's why we get similar values for the maximum mass and the corresponding radius for boson stars and for fermion stars. So what people actually did, they didn't really discuss. And if you go to the literature, there are classic papers. And in classic papers, they usually discuss the boson stars in terms of some field theory. So assume a classical field theory and then solve this classical field theory together with the Einstein equations. So they have a coupled system where they have an equation of motion for the scalar field and an equation of motion from gravity, basically. And this is coupled. So they really solve the full differential equations and then get out some masses and stuff like that. But they recover basically the same feature as here, so that they get now masses of boson stars, which are very similar to fermion stars. Now, we can do I just did a simple exercise. So if I say that the mass of the boson is, say, 1 GeV, like for a nucleon, we don't know of any boson which has this, except maybe for some vector mesons, the phi meson, but this is not stable. Then we see that for non-interacting, so a fuzzball on non-interacting case, then the mass is about 10 to minus 19 solar masses, and the radius is about 10 to minus 19 kilometers. So this is actually 10 to minus 19 kilometers, or if I say 10 kilometers, then it's 10 to minus 18, makes life easier. 10 to minus 18, so we're talking about 10 to minus 15 meters, so this has the scale of about a Fermi. A Fermi. That's what comes out because of the quantum uncertainty, right? We assume 1 GeV, so we have to get out a mass scale of the proton, 1 Fermi. 10 to minus 19 times the mass of the sun, I just argued, was 10 to 14 grams. This is something like a mountain or so. If I include interactions, then the mass is about 1 solar mass, and the radius is about 10 kilometers, right? Like for an ordinary neutron star. Yeah, and here, basically, I assume that y is at the order of one. Y is at the order of one, the action scale. Good. Any questions to boson stars? So let's have a 5-minute break, and then we just start with a new chapter. The question was, can I repeat, please, what I said about gluons in the beginning of boson stars? Okay, he was thinking about a boson star made out of bosons and gluons. That's what your idea was?
Just gluons.
Mesons and gluons. Not like a pion ball, like a pion star, for example. Yeah. Interesting, we just put out a paper, or we're just working on a paper on pion stars. So in principle, you can really think about it, making a star out of pions, which are interacting by strong interactions. Basically, some particle exchange, which is where the underlying force is quantum chromodynamics, or the exchange of gluons.
And this is, I think, you can assume that this is like a state in the star, maybe in the more, when the degrees of freedom are this degrees of freedom, so it's like in the core of a neutron star, for example. Is this my question is this a model for the core of a neutron star, for example?
The boson star, you mean? Pion star? The question was, is the boson star, the pion star, a model for the core of a neutron star? Maybe. The issue is that you have baryons around, and that number is conserved. So you will not have you will most likely not have just a shell of a neutron star, and in the core there's a boson star. But it could be that you have a whole sphere of a neutron star, and in the core of that neutron star, there is a pion star, which means there's some pion condensation going on. There's a Bose-Einstein condensate of pions. That's some possibility. People have been discussing this already in the 70s. Migdal did this. Pion condensation was a big hype. Then in the 80s, they did it with kaons, which are just a strangeness analog of the pion, also bosons, which could condense. Was also a big hype because, as we will see, it reduces the maximum mass of a neutron star. and it would have left room for mini black holes in a galaxy. So there was a scenario by Hans Bethe and Jerry Brown from the 90s about this. So we don't know. Maybe there is a pion condensation inside in the core of a neutron star. So are there observable differences between a boson star and a fermion star? So if I have a neutron star, I know in the outer layers I have ordinary material, like I have on Earth. I have atoms, I have hydrogen atoms, I have helium, maybe silicon, carbon, whatever, maybe iron. So they're the elements, the usual elements I have around a neutron star. So when I do an observation of a neutron star, I should see those spectral lines. I should see features which resemble that of having an atmosphere of elements. For a boson star, it's different. So for a boson star, there are no nucleons around, just bosons. So unless I have charged bosons, if I have charged bosons, I would need also electrons to neutralize the object. So I can think about bosonic atoms. So this would be then atoms where I have a core of bosons, which are stabilized by some interaction, but then they need also some attractive interaction and the electrons around it, and they would have bosonic atoms if this is a stable form of matter, and then they would see different spectral lines. Or I would not see any spectral lines. So if the boson is uncharged, for example, and there are no electrons around, it could be that the boson does not couple directly to photons, so it would be a black star. It would look like a black hole. There's no interaction with photons. Photons just go through. They don't see it even. They just go through even. They are not absorbed. They just go through. There's no radiative heating, actually, of that boson star. Another question?
Could we distinguish between fermion boson stars looking at interaction from material of, like, an accretion disk that gets drawn onto the star? Mm-hmm.
So the question was about having an accretion disk. So if I have a boson star and a companion star accreting matter, we should see a difference, which was because the interactions should be different. When matter is falling onto a neutron star, we know there are some explosive phenomena happening. There are so-called de novae. All the novae we have around ordinary stars and white dwarfs, we will see regular flashes of some matter ignited to very high temperatures, so we have some burning processes going on. And for a boson star, if it doesn't interact electromagnetically, then we wouldn't see these highly energetic outbursts interaction with nucleons. So there should be a difference.
Where would the matter then go if it doesn't, like, erupt in the burst? Would it just be
So, of course, there could be bursts that, within the accretion disk, there could be some bursts if matter is just compressed very much. And then if matter is falling onto the boson star, it would not fall onto the surface of the boson star. It would directly collapse to the very core of the boson star. So this actually could mean that we would get even more gravitational binding energy. So highly energetic gamma rays would emerge probably by this, when this blob is then compressed and gets this gravitational binding energy, it has to release eventually this gravitational binding energy. And this would...
this be a test to actually observe boson stars for the active search for them?
Yeah, I haven't thought about this one, but this might be an idea to look for accreting binary systems and see what's... Most of them are compatible with what we know about neutron stars and white dwarfs. But what they are looking at is the so-called innermost stable circular orbit, and that innermost circular orbit only depends on the mass of the star, not on the composition. So it would be the same for a fermion star and a boson star if they have the same compactness. you can clearly distinguish between fermion stars and boson stars if you see unusually masses and radii. So if you see something which has is stable and has a mass of 10 to minus 3 solar masses. 10 to minus 3 solar masses and a meter-sized object, by whatever reason, or which has 100 solar masses and then 1,000 kilometer diameter, which you would have for a boson star, but you can never have it for a neutron star. Then, of course, you see it directly, immediately. Yeah, it's a good question. People have not been really thinking about boson stars so deeply. What people are doing is with the black hole cam. They can look at the shadow of the black hole, and the shadow of a black hole is just given by the Schwarzschild horizon, while the shadow of a boson star would be different because it's not really a black hole. Photons just go through, so the shadow would be different for a boson star. So eventually, when this data is coming out next year from the black hole cam, we will know whether the supermassive black hole is really a black hole or something else by measuring the shadow. Okay, any more questions about compact stars in general, boson stars? So we start a new chapter on white dwarfs. Let's discuss first a little bit of history of white dwarfs. So the historical note is that, classically one says that in 1862, I think I mentioned this before, right? Alvin Clark observed Sirius B and discovered Sirius B, which is a small companion to Sirius A, and that that has a mass, and this is a white dwarf. So 10 years ago, this was considered to be the first observed white dwarf, but if you go to some old data from William Herschel, in his notes, he also observed of Procyon B, and Procyon B later was also a white dwarf. So probably before, by Herschel, was discovered before. Yeah, also with I think Herschel already noted that the spectrum is unusual of that object, but he didn't really consider it further. But Sirius B, later on, came the classic example of a very weird object. A very weird object because they measured the spectrum. They can measure the effective temperature of Sirius B by assuming it's a black body. And this is turning out to something like 25,193 plus minus 37 Kelvin. And the mass is 1.18 plus minus 0.011 solar masses. And the radius is 0.00864. plus minus 0.00012 times the radius of the sun. Yeah. If I write it like this, it is clear that somehow the mass scale is off. This is the mass of the sun, ordinary sun. You would say, okay, it's maybe an ordinary star, but if you look at the radius, that radius is off by two orders of magnitude compared to the sun. So the central density is not 150 gram per cubic centimeters as for the sun, or the average density is not 1 gram per cubic centimeters, but the average density then is a factor 100 cubed larger. So the average density, rho bar, is about 10 to 6 gram per cubic centimeters. Yeah, and compared to the 1 gram per cubic centimeters for the sun, this is outrageously large. Yeah, and people were really puzzled when this came out. So they They first measure the effective temperature. Basically, they get the mass from the orbit. And the radius they got from gravitational redshift. So this got confirmed. In principle, if one knows the distance, one can also estimate the radius, but the real confirmation came with the gravitational redshift. And I think I wrote this down also the last time, that 1925, then Adams measured the redshift. And from this redshift measurement, you get R, or you get M over R, right? And if you know mass, then M over R. And that was not in the range of the sun, which is 10 to minus 8 or so, but it was more in the ballpark of delta C. Was at the order of 10 to minus 4, which is outrageously large compared to the sun, which is, I think, 10 to minus 8. Okay, so this got people really puzzled. How can a star be so massive and have such a small radius? Now we know what it is. It is a white dwarf stabilized by the Fermi pressure. And it happened that just in 1925, 26, Fowler formulated the Fermi pressure. So just in 1925, I think Fermi included the Fermi statistics, and then there is a Fermi pressure. 1925 was actually also the year when Heisenberg discovered the Heisenberg uncertainty relation. This was the year when also Schrödinger wrote down then eventually his equation, the Schrödinger equation. This all happened in the mid-20s. So then came so in 1926, explanation was given by Fowler. So it's stabilized by Fermi pressure of electrons. Yeah, he did it non-relativistically. And then it took a few years, 1931, 1930, then came Chandrasekhar with the maximum mass. With its maximum mass. Right. And I don't know if you know, do you know the story about Chandrasekhar? Did I tell you about how he discovered this, the maximum mass? He was a young guy who, I think he was only 19 when he discovered this, and he was going from India to Britain to work with Eddington, the big astronomer at that time. And it was said that during the passage on the ship, I mean, he was taking the ship, and this ship just takes, I don't know how many weeks or even months, because it has, at that time, did they sail through? I'm not sure. So it took several weeks or even months for him to go from India to Great Britain by ship, and then he had all his stuff on board of the ship, and he said on the ship he did all the calculations and calculated the maximum mass of this white dwarf. Okay. So, that was some history, and now we're coming to mass-radius relation for polytropes. We had a discussion about it before when looking at the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation. Here we want to look now at non-relativistic stars and solve later on the so-called Lane-Emden equation precisely. Okay, so we start with a polytrope in the classic sense, which means the pressure is proportional to some constant k times n to the power gamma. where k is a constant and gamma is also a constant. And sometimes this is called the adiabatic index because people are using it also for thermal equation of state. In our case, we put the temperature to be zero, so it wouldn't really make sense to call this an adiabatic index. You can call it maybe the polytropic power. Later on, we will introduce the polytropic index n, which is different compared to this one. It's not a polytropic index, it's just a polytropic power, so to say. So, as we have seen this before. Yeah. We can now replace, if you say the mass density is the mass of the nucleon, basically, times the number density, then we can rephrase that relation as being a kappa prime times rho to the power of gamma. Yeah, where kappa prime is now different from kappa, from k by the mass scale of the nucleon. Good. Let's look at a sphere in hydrostatic equilibrium. And we know from mechanics, this is dp over dr. The gradient in the pressure is balanced by the gravitational force. So this is minus g times m contained within the radius r times the mass density as a function of r divided by r squared, non-relativistically. Yeah. So m of r is equal integral d3r prime rho of r prime. Yeah. Mass within sphere. Of radius. R. 0 to R. Okay, then we also know what the total mass of the star is. Total mass is then, if you say that mr, when small r is equal capital R. Right, so I don't write it down again. Good. So let's make some crude assumptions, a crude model. So we say that now the mass density is the average mass density, which is m over r cubed, 4 pi times 3. Yeah, this is the average density. Average mass density, rho through bar. So then we say the pressure gradient dp over dr, we approximate with a delta p over delta r. And delta r is just the radius of the star. And the delta p is just the pressure in the core. And this gives minus the pressure, the central pressure over the radius of the star, where pc is the central pressure. Roughly, and r is the radius of the star. Yeah, let's plug this into our differential equation. Then we find the central pressure over r is about g times the mass of the star times the average mass rho over r squared. Okay. Yeah. So this goes like G times M squared over R to the fifth power. M over R cubed. R just goes like 1 over R squared. Ah, there's an R missing here. R squared, so this goes like R to the fifth power. So this means the central pressure is proportional to, I leave out factors 4 pi and 3, so this goes like G M squared over R to the fourth power. Okay. By the way, this relation is known through astronomers. They use it regularly to estimate central pressures of astronomical objects, of stars, for example. This is used in stellar evolution theory to estimate the central pressure of not only of white dwarfs, what we're doing here, but also for ordinary stars. So this is a standard procedure. Good. So now plug in the polytropes. So polytropes means that the central pressure is given by a kappa prime times rho bar gamma. Yeah, this is our polytrope. And this shall be equal now to the other expression we had on this side, g m squared over r to the fourth power. Okay, so this means that the k prime times m over r cubed to the power of gamma is proportional to g m squared over r to the fourth power. Now we can rearrange terms, and one finds this goes like m to 2 minus gamma. M to 2 minus gamma. So the radius goes like minus 3 gamma, so this gives a plus 3 gamma minus 4. So this is 3 gamma minus 4 on the right-hand side. And then this is basically proportional to or given by the value of kappa prime over g, which is a constant. And this is the mass radius relation of polytropes. We have seen this before. Where have we seen this before? We have seen it when discussing the Landau mass and the Landau radius. We have exactly the same mass radius relation. M to the power 2 minus gamma, R to the power 3 gamma minus 4 is a constant. That's exactly what we had before. Right. What we can do now is we can do a stability analysis also. If you look at the cases, at different cases, so let's say the case that this gamma is smaller than 4/3. If you go back to this balancing equation here, this one here, we see that gravity goes like 1 over r to the fourth power. While here the other term, the pressure term, which is balancing gravity, goes like 1 over r to the power 3 gamma. So if I put in gamma equal 4/3, then also this term on this side would go like 1 over r to the fourth power. But if gamma is smaller, say gamma is equal 1, then this goes like 1 over r cubed. That now what's happening if if the star is shrinking, this is continuously increasing compared to this one. So gravity wins, so the star collapses eventually. PC is proportional to R to minus 3 gamma, and gravity goes like 1 over R minus 4 from gravity. This is, let's say, this is the Fermi pressure. And this is the force from gravity. So the whole star unstable collapses to a black hole. Collapses to R goes to zero. Yeah. We can't really see this from this relation here, but we see it from the relation above. That's why we did this derivation. So there's the limiting case, gamma equals 4/3. Yeah, we see that in this relation, the 1 over r to the 4th term drops out on both sides. This, again, is the limiting case of stability. Note that we do not need to resort to the other discussions we had before. This is just given by hydrostatic equilibrium, not the case that we have a particle sitting on top of it and stuff like this. Right? This concerns really the whole sphere. And then from this relation here, we see that the radius drops out and that the mass is constant. And that mass is just the Chandrasekhar limiting mass. Maximum mass. Again, the maximum mass is covered by different means. And we know gamma equal 4/3 is the relativistic limit. This is what Chandrasekhar found out. So, of course, we know also the other limits. We can even do more for the maximum mass, M must be proportional to K prime over G. Yeah. And to the 3/2. Yeah, gamma is 4/3, so this gives a 2/3 here. So this goes like K prime over G to the 3/2. This goes like the Planck mass squared, so it will eventually go like the Planck mass cubed. And this K prime, then you can plug in the relation we had for polytropes, and this turns out then to be just a mass scale M squared. Good. So we can discuss now the next case. You know, gamma equals 5/3. And then we see that M is proportional to M times R cubed is equal constant. And that's the one for free Fermi gas. Yeah. And we discussed also the case gamma equal 2. We have exactly the same. Then the mass term drops out. The radius is constant. This is the case for an interacting Fermi gas. But it works also for bosons, as we have seen. And then there's another limiting case. Case gamma is equal to 2 plus delta. So why did I put in 2 plus delta? Because at gamma equal 2, the whole situation and the mass radius relation changes. It changes its character. And it goes like m times r to the power of minus 2 over delta plus 3. So we get a minus sign here if delta is non-zero. Mass radius increases. With M. Yeah. And then the limiting case is when we send gamma to infinity, we get a case for incompressible matter, and then basically m is proportional to r cubed. So then this mass radius relation, if I look at it, goes like this. That's a new one we didn't have before. And that's the one we had actually discussed, I think, for quark stars. You have exactly that feature. So any questions to this discussion about white dwarfs and hydrostatic equilibrium and polytropes? So the question is if we can choose different values of gamma between 5/3 and 2, we can choose some other numbers. In principle, you can choose any number you want. It could be also some weird number. If there's some weird interaction between particles, it can have some number which is completely off the numbers given here. In terms of stability, you should be sure that it's always larger than 4/3, of course. Yeah. But in principle, it can go to infinity. Then you would just rediscover the case of an incompressible fluid. You try to compress it, and then the pressure just shoots up to the roof because gamma goes to infinity. That's what it means. We are with gamma goes to infinity.
What's the delta?
The delta is just my notation that I have a gamma which is larger than 2. So basically, this means gamma is larger than 2. I want to discuss what is going to happen when gamma is 2. So if it's below 2, the radius decreases when the mass increases. So the slope is like this. If gamma is equal to 2, we have a constant radius. If gamma is larger than 2, we have actually an increasing radius with mass. So it changes the slope. So gamma equal 2 is special as it is this turning point. Yeah. That's, we choose 4/3 because it is this limit, 2 because it is this limit in the slope, and 5/3 because it gives the case of a free gas. But you can think about other values if you want. Gamma equals 3 would even give some strange behavior. Yeah, you can try different numbers. So time is up. If there are no further questions, then we reconvene on Thursday, the last time before Christmas, for the exercises and then the 1-hour lecture. Okay, see you then.